This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today is a very special holiday. It's Pi Day. That's P-I Day, and it's 3/14/16. Now, before you come after me, I know the number is 3.1415926 and on. Actually, if you go to piday.org, you can see them written out to the millionth digit if you're so inclined. But anyway, today on March 14th, 2016, we are rounding up. So 31416. Basically, it's just a good excuse to do a show about math and to talk about some interesting stuff going on around our region with some interesting mathematicians who think in fractions and fractals and differential equations. We're going to share some math jokes that people have been posting on the Vermont Edition Facebook page as well, so head over there to join the fun. It's pretty cheesy. Our first guest is UVM Professor of Mathematics and Statistics, Chris Danforth. Welcome back to the show, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So it is Pi Day. You're going to have to give us the remedial lesson for people who just vaguely remember 3.14, and I don't even know what that means kind of thing. So what's pi?
Sure. So a mathematician thinks about pi as the circumference of a circle, the distance you would walk around the circle, the ratio of that number to the diameter of the circle, which is if you went straight across it from one side to the other. So that ratio is a little bit more than 3, and it's something that people have known about for thousands of years now, but it's a number that really shows up in almost every fundamental law that we scientists come up with about how the universe works. So it's really a remarkable example of how nature communicates the fundamental laws to us.
I get that, you know, no matter how big or small a circle is, that ratio is always going to stay the same. So no matter the size of the circle, that ratio is always 3.14159, et cetera. But what do you mean when you say that it shows up in every law of how the universe works?
Sure, sure. So we could think about, let's say, just the big and the small. So to start, the there are scientists now that use satellites to look at distant stars and try and decide whether or not planets orbiting those stars could harbor life. And one of the important questions they need to answer is how far away a planet is from a star. And so they'll observe moments when the planets pass in front of those stars, and there's a dip in intensity of light coming to the satellite from those stars. And so from that dip in intensity, they can back out how far away the planet is from that star. And that's a calculation that requires a very precise estimate of its mass, and that also requires understanding of the orbit that it takes around the star, which is a nearly circular orbit. So that's an example of pi showing up in a really big calculation. But it also shows up in Schrodinger's equation of how fundamental particles work in quantum mechanics.
So is that why people care so much about pi? Because, you know, it can sometimes seem like, why do we all know this one number that's so fundamental? And, you know, fewer people are talking about golden rectangles.
Sure, sure. No, I think there are a few reasons. One is that, you know, people, you know, sometimes people need to know the answer to a question like, how many ping pong balls would fit into a bus? So, you know, kids
yes,
love
that,
to try
we
and...
we all need to know the
you all,
answer to that.
You all need to know these things. But, I think that it's an example of, you know, what mathematicians are really interested in is understanding infinite phenomenon. And pi is an example of a number who, you know, when you try and write down what it looks like, it's a set of digits that never repeats. And it's an example of what we call an irrational number in mathematics. Most of the numbers we encounter in our lives are not like that. They're integers. And you can actually create pi or approximate it closely by adding up a bunch of fractions of integers. But the difference between those two things is something that we find really fascinating, and we try and understand, why the world looks the way it does when we approximate things.
Listeners, I want to have you join the conversation if you're so inclined. I know there are a lot of people out there who love pi, who love math. We're talking math jokes as well. You can share a math joke on the phone if you want, or you can go to our Facebook page. There's already a bunch. We've been populating it with staffers at VPR who have really bad math jokes. But we are also talking about pi right now with Chris Danforth. And if you have a question about pi, now is the time to call about that. 1-800-639-2211 is our number. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Berlin Elementary School. Cindy emailed in to say our 4th, 5th, and 6th graders are making apple pie today and learning about pi in math class. And Professor Danforth, I'm curious for you how many digits you can go out if you've ever memorized a bunch of pi digits and why you think, especially kids, find it so fun to memorize pi out to as many digits as possible.
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to disappoint you now by telling you that the number you gave, 3.1415, is about as far as I'm able to go myself. But yeah, I think that kids, you know, they're, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th grade, 10-year-old kids are really at a fundamental age to try and understand the world around them. They're trying to make sense of what rules exist for how things behave, and, you know, in nature. And pi shows up in, you know, in almost all the phenomenon we look at. And so I think that they hear about that and they think, well, this is something I should try and understand a little bit better. And they're also, you know, they're at an age where, you know, memorization is, unfortunately, it's a lot of what they're told to do to try and get better at math. Things are changing in the way math is taught. But they're, you know, I think that they're excited about the idea also of eating pie and throwing pie in people's faces and things like this. So, you know, and the jokes, the horrible jokes, let's just do some more of those. Those are great. So,
all right. Yeah, so, okay, we've got some jokes. The one that I posted up there is, why is 6 afraid of 7? Because 7, 8, 9, yuck, yuck, yuck. Angela Evansy says, what do you call a number that can't keep still? A Roman numeral.
Well done.
Laura Schoenfeld says, what did the 0 say to the 8? Nice belt. See, I know you know all of these. You're laughing. You're humoring us, and I appreciate that.
It's fantastic,
Chris.
Yeah.
What did one decimal say to the other? Did you get my point? They're pretty good. Do you have any math jokes? Yours are probably very erudite, and you know, you're sharing them at cocktail parties.
You know, I don't have a ton of them, but I do have one. So I have... Okay. Did you know the roundest knight at King Arthur's round table was circumference? Why? Too much pie.
But I'm pumped. We got a more serious question, or a comment rather, from Nicole, who says, when composer Edward Elgar published his Enigma variations, he left it as a puzzle what the underlying theme was for the variations. In 2010, Charles and Matthew Santa put forward the suggestion, now widely accepted, that Elgar used pi as the basis for the theme, in particular the initial 4 rounded digits, 3.142, and the corresponding musical notes. And I find that interesting. I didn't know that. But Professor Danforth, there's also a lot of really neat connections between math and music that are very cool to explore. I mean, maybe we could do a whole other show on that sometime.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, the idea of a circle walking around its circumference and coming back to where you started, pi shows up in nature anytime you have a phenomenon that repeats. And cyclic phenomenon like waves, the equations of motion of waves are described by terms that involve pi. And so so certainly there are connections. If you think about, you know, the chords on a guitar or on a piano, and different combinations of sounds that appeal to us. You know, there's something about that that's very mathematical in nature. In fact, it can't be too precise. If we listen to computer-generated music, you know, it something about that doesn't tickle our brains the way human music does.
Again, our number, if you'd like to share a math joke with us, or if you have a question about pi, or if you're working on something that you want to talk about that's math-related, we're sort of having a broad, wide-ranging discussion today, and we'd love to hear it. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And let's talk now with Scott Lefevre. He's a junior at Norwich University, and he's working on a project that has an application in the health sector. Scott, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jane. It's a pleasure to be on. So you're curious about my research.
I am. I understand you actually had a project in class that you were supposed to look at an understudied disease, and you looked at something called Bruelli ulcers. So before we get into the models that you created, just explain what Bruelli ulcers are and how serious of a medical condition they are.
Well, according to the World Health Organization, they are an understudied disease or a neglected disease. Basically, that means there's a lot of cases of it throughout the world, in South America, all over Africa, and some places in India as well. But there's so many cases, but yet no one has looked at it. A lot of people nowadays are mainly focused on Ebola and some of the more prevalent diseases. But this disease is it's just not known to a lot of people, and it's pretty terrible. It's a flesh-eating bacterial disease. So once you've contracted it, it actually begins to degrade away at your flesh.
Ugh, sounds pretty horrible and understudied, so it's great that you were looking at it. So where did the math come in? What did you do?
Well, so I was given this disease by the Massey and Massimo. They're two conferences that work out of Africa. And so this past summer, for about 6 weeks, I studied basic epidemiology is what it's called, and that's just the mathematics of how diseases spread. Epidemiology has been around for a long time, but it mainly It just shows, gives you several equations, and it tells you how people who are susceptible, people who are infected, and people who are recovered, and how they all interact with each other, and how that disease spreads, and what are the most important factors of how it spreads.
Okay, so explain how you made the models then to start working on this illness.
Well, it's not really known how Borrelia ulcers are spread. They have a general idea, and they think it's through insects in the water or the water itself, and there's no definite evidence of that. So to begin, I made two separate models. I made a water model and an insect model, and it used the water model used like people who interacted with the water, and then those people and how they interacted with the people they see every day, their families, their friends, and how it spreads in that kind of way. And then the second model, the insect model, basically used how if you're in the water or you're near the water and you get bit by one of the insects that carries it, then you then can spread it to your family or your friends. And the insect model is a bit more complicated because you have to account for the whole population of humans, but as well as the population of insects. So there was a bit of guessing involved at first, and I think with further research you could definitely cut down the number of guesses you have to make on insect populations and things like that.
But it turns out the insect population model was the one that was more predictive, right?
Yes. As I read more cases of Borrelia ulcers throughout the world and just looked into it more, it seemed that the insect model would work better because there were more insects in each case. There, even if it was just mentioned that there were insects in the water or anything like that, that's good enough for me to guess that the insect model was probably better.
So,
actually the research that I took with me to Africa.
Okay, so then explain what you did when you took this research to Africa, because you have these models, but you haven't been on the ground. You're not doing studies where you ask individuals, how do you think you contracted this illness? So how do you then apply those models to something that's helpful in studying or helping to find a cure for this disease?
Well, the MASSI and MASSIMU conference in Africa is full of American students as well as African students and African PhDs, African doctors. They've all worked with the disease or they've seen it in person. And that, I think, was a huge help because when I got there, I was able to present what I had learned. And I actually met an African student who had done nearly the exact same research that I had. And it was actually pretty impressive when we compared notes that it was actually that close.
How do you apply this then, now that you've done this work, to actually doing something in real life?
So in real life, basically what you can do with these models is you can look at it and you can play with the parameters. So one of the parameters was the number of insects biting people. And if you can decrease that number, like just a small amount, it severely changes the effect of the spread of the disease. So in real life, you could suggest to populations of farmers, children, people who are in the water, playing in the water, that they can wear long sleeves, long pants, just decrease the exposure they have to the water or to even the insects in the water. And that will severely decrease the spread of the disease. There are antibiotics you can take, but you have to catch Borrelia ulcers at an early stage in order for those to work. Otherwise, once it begins its course of action, you have to get a surgery to get it removed.
Scott, are you going to keep studying this? Is this something that's really caught your interest, or was this, you know, a math class question that sort of now you move on to other things? I mean, you are studying other things as well.
Yes, I'm a mechanical engineer, actually. It's my major, and I have a mathematics minor. So this came up in a math course, and it honestly has captured my attention quite a bit. So this research, I think I will continue it, and I'm actually working on publishing, or not publishing, I'm working on developing a final paper that I'm hoping to get published in a mathematics journal.
Scott, talk to the kids out there or the parents sometimes who say, you know, it's fine, you got to learn this stuff for school, but there's not a lot of practical applications. Math is boring, or math doesn't have anything to do with the real world. I mean, you're sort of proving them wrong just by talking to us, but how do you address that faction of the population?
Well, honestly, Math is everything. You can't ignore it. It is, it's part of our everyday world. And I've seen that just with this research, and I've also seen it just with engineering. There's an immense amount of work that goes into developing everything around you in everyday life. An example of that would be if you go get a key made, like you have to go remake a key, that machine is just an advanced piece of mathematics and engineering all in one. And everything you do is just everything. Math, engineering, medical field, all of it has to do with math. So you can't ignore it. And I think if you really want to get a good understanding of the world or just anything in the world, you can't ignore math. It's got to be part of your life.
Scott, thank you so much for talking with us about your research, and best of luck. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. This is a great show.
Scott Lefevre is a junior at Norwich University. Chris Danforth, you're a professor at UVM. It must warm the cockles of your heart to hear about
fantastic.
Somebody talking about math like that.
Yeah, I mean, so Scott is he's doing research that's, you know, it's part of a really important component of the field right now, which is taking the data that's available, what little there is about phenomenon that we don't understand well, especially in developing countries, and trying to build models where we can, you know, simulate on the computer in seconds millions and millions of outbreaks of diseases like this, and then tweak small parameters to see what effect different strategies of intervention could have. So if it's an epidemiological situation, you might consider closing schools for a week, you know, over spring break, like we do sometimes now to slow down the flu, or maybe shutting down an airport here or there, you know, exactly who to go and target as, you know, with treatment. So I think it's a great example that he gave us. Yeah.
Well, we did get a note from Jeff in Grand Isle who said, I'm an engineer and a parent. And when I talk to students and teachers, they say the way math is taught in primary and secondary education is boring. Do you have any ideas on making it more interesting to learn?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not an area of my own expertise. I'm used to having students who are, you know, in college. But I think that, you know, the people that I've interacted in the field today who are studying, you know, here at Vermont, for example, we have the Vermont Mathematics Initiative that is attempting to teach educators who, you know, maybe one of the reasons they end up teaching at that level is that they really don't like math, but they end up being the first contact students have with it. And, you know, those students, there are other ways to engage them related to it. And I think, you know, the parents have a responsibility here too, even if it's something they're a little afraid of, to go outside their comfort zone. There's lots of resources online. There's beautiful videos that can get at different types of learning styles. So I think, you know, a responsible, literate parent should be working to try and teach their kids about these things.
Is that what you do? You've got kids, right?
Absolutely. Got a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, Harper and Afton. And we talk about puzzles all the time. We just learned how to solve the Rubik's Cube together. It's a lot of fun.
Well, we're going to have some suggestions for ways that you can talk about math questions coming up later in the program. So we will get to some of those things. And, you know, if your kids like jokes, you can always go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We've got jokes coming in. Pete Hirschfeld says, hey, I have one. How do you turn a 3D printer into a 4D printer? Just give it some time. And Sam Gale Rosen, one of our producers, shamelessly stole his joke from the internet. Question is, what does the B stand for in Benoit B. Mandelbrot? Answer, Benoit B. Mandelbrot. All right, some of these are getting a little bit esoteric for me. Annie Russell says, last night I dreamed that I was weightless. I was like, OMG, but it's a zero MG. Yeah, go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Please give us some better ones. The staffers are struggling now. Or call 1-800-639-2211. Before we take a break, let's go to Michael, who's calling in from Windsor. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead. You're on the air. Oh, nope, we lost Michael. All right, we will try again coming up after our break. 1-800-639-2211 is our number, or go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're celebrating Pi Day, 3-1-4-1-6, and yes, we're rounding up. We're talking chaos theory and more with UVM Math and Statistics Professor Chris Danforth. And you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 if you have a question for him, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Roger, who's calling in from Waterbury Center. Hi, Roger. Go right ahead. You're on the air. Roger, you hearing
Hello?
Me? Hi, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I just was calling in to suggest that if you could queue up or anybody could find a copy of a song by Tom Lehrer called Lobachevsky. It's Lehrer himself was a mathematician who taught at Harvard or MIT, but he was a satirical songwriter in the 50s and 60s. And Bobuchevsky deals with plagiarism and the near simultaneous discovery of non-Euclidean mathematics by Nikolai Lobachevsky in Russia and a guy named Bolyai. My dad was a math professor at the University of Michigan, and he used to play this for grad students who would come over for parties. And they would all sit around and laugh, and I had no idea what was going on.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. It's always fun to think back not only on math and music and jokes, but the things that your parents did. That's fun. And Chris Danforth, we've been taking jokes on our Facebook page, some math jokes. Some of them I get pretty easily, some of them not so much. Al Keefe wrote in to say, what's the difference between a mathematician and a physicist? When a physicist talks to you, he stares at your feet. But I think the joke here is that, you know, the physicists are more outgoing. The mathematicians stare at their own.
I suppose that's the implication.
But you actually were going to help me understand Sam Gelrosen's joke about Benoit Mandelbrot.
Right. So Mandelbrot was a scientist working at IBM in the 60s trying to understand financial time series data. And one of the things that he noticed was that the prices of, let's say, a stock ticker would move up and down in a way that if you remove the labels, you couldn't really tell if it was movement over a year or over the course of a day. So there's a self-similarity in that those observations that you would get. And so that's where the Benoit B. Mandelbrot having his middle name of being Benoit B. Mandelbrot comes from. That's where the joke comes from. So but he's a person who was trying to model phenomenon in the real world, and you know, had at the time the mathematical tools available to him were very smooth curves, but he was observing things in nature that looked very rough. So he and others helped develop this new field called fractal geometry to describe objects in nature whose dimension was not an integer. And so that's a phenomenon related to chaos.
You see, my Benoit references are like Joni Benoit Samuelson.
Okay, yeah.
So you've even got the French one here. And actually, this is something that you know a lot about, because one of the things that you study and one of the things you wanted to talk about today is chaos theory.
Yeah, sure. So I'm very excited about this. When I was in high school, I think I saw this Jurassic Park movie, and Jeff Goldblum seduced me with his leather jacket and and his description of sensitive dependence. So I went on to learn about this, and so the story goes, basically there was a meteorologist at MIT named Ed Lorenz trying to really convince the National Weather Service that their linear methods of predicting the future, which were basically, you know, in Vermont we would call Ohio and find out, well, what's the weather like there today? We'll predict that that's what it's like here tomorrow. And he was trying to convince them this was really not going to work. So he developed a very simple model for the atmosphere. You know, imagine kind of putting it in a box and a fluid in a box and heating it and cooling it and trying to see what happens. And what he found, he was working with a computer that had about 60 kilobytes of RAM back in the 60s, which is about the same size as a Microsoft Word document the second you open it. So he had a very small computer to work on. But he found basically that when he predicted what would happen in his toy climate using the computer, they didn't have much memory. So he would go back and try and make the same prediction again. And it was very difficult to do. And it was because they would diverge quickly. And this phenomenon became known as the butterfly effect. And he went on to describe basically that if you hung a thermometer from every square foot in the atmosphere all around the Earth, and you fed that all those observations of what's going on into an infinite computer with perfect knowledge of what Mother Nature's governing equations are, you know, basically you could only predict the weather for about 2 weeks, because all the stuff happening, you know, inside those square feet, all the little butterflies flapping their wings, that behavior would start to matter on that time scale. And so that was the limit of predictability he found. And my advisor at the University of Maryland, Jim York, about 10 years later, went on to coin the phrase chaos to describe this phenomenon. He gave it the big sell. So chaos. and so it's you know, there's still really important research going on in this field now, both related to weather prediction, where we have, you know, satellites giving us billions of observations every day of what the Earth looks like in various spectra. And then, you know, feeding those observations into a computer, and every few minutes, the National Weather Service creates a new forecast of what the next week is going to be like. And our predictions have gotten a lot better. It's really one of the biggest success stories in science, I think, is our ability to take this chaotic phenomenon that's, you know, where there's this sensitive dependence and any small change has a big outcome, and be able to describe it very well. And in terms of uncertainty, at least, we have a good sense. You know, is this going to be a hard thing to predict? Or is this going to be an easy thing to predict? So hurricanes, for example, they're very hard to predict how strong they'll be, but their track, we're getting very good at predicting their track, again, with these big fancy computer models that that I, you know, I myself have worked on a little bit.
I love that something that's called chaos theory, it's still possible to sort of wrap your arms around it and to be predictive within this idea that it's chaos, or that, you know, things are unpredictable. There's prediction within an unpredictable world.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that, you know, that's really, mathematics is about trying to find that line and quantify uncertainty associated with our understanding of the world. And I think that, you know, one great example of this today is climate. So you've just heard me tell you, we're never going to predict the weather 2 weeks from now, no matter how good our observations are. But we're able to, with these computer models, you know, make these experimental guesses about what's going to happen. So we can't go into a laboratory and create 5,000 Earths and give them different compositions of carbon dioxide, for example, and see what happens. But we can take a computer model and do the same experiment. And that's what scientists with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have done, to try and decide how likely it is that humans are responsible for the warming of the atmosphere, and, you know, what will our climate look like in 100 years. And so that really, that you can think of the computer as the laboratory environment for studies like climate change.
We got a joke from John in Thetford. Those two parallel lines have so much in common. Too bad they'll never meet. And Lyle's on the line with us from Belvedere. Hi, Lyle. Go ahead.
It's not a math joke per se. It's a scientific joke or a chemistry joke. And just asking people, did you hear about the date that oxygen had with potassium?
No.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm waiting for the punchline.
Hello?
Oh, Lyle.
Finish it off, Lyle. Finish it off.
Do you have the punchline?
Yeah, okay. I'm trying to get you. Okay, can you hear me now?
We can hear you just fine, and we're dying to know.
My joke is, did you hear about the date between oxygen and potassium?
No, tell me.
Well, it turned out okay.
But we got there. Lyle, thank you for the joke. I love it. That counts. That counts. You know, we got a note from Sam in Bath, New Hampshire, who says, please remind listeners there's no such thing as a math person. This misconception holds back many students and adults from learning the joys of mathematics. I hear you, Sam. We are all math people, and certainly all math people here today on the show and on Pi Day. Chris in Middlebury says, for years I've read that Bach's music appeals to so many because of a fundamental mathematical basis that resonates with us somehow subconsciously. Even those of us for whom math is not a natural or particularly accessible domain. I hear you. Music and math, we've talked about that a little bit today as well. And let's get another voice in here, someone else doing some interesting stuff with math. Sathyan Davidos is a professor of mathematics at Williams College, although he's spending this year teaching at the Claremont Colleges in California, and he joins us from out west. Sathyan, nice to have you back on the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Yes, you're probably much warmer than we are this year.
Oh, fantastic.
So you actually wanted to pose some math questions for us. Let's just dive right into one of them.
Yeah, I thought, you know, this is Pi Day. I absolutely love food, and I also love to draw and think about pictures. So I wanted your listeners to understand math in terms of just visual things, things they can actually hold and do in their hand at home rather than abstract concepts. So here's a question for you, right? Let's pretend that you have a pie and I have a pie. And let's make things really simple. Let's pretend that our pies are polygons, right? So no smooth curves and no, you know, nothing too complicated, just simple flat sides for your pie and my pie. But make your pie as complicated as you want to based on your polygon. And we have those two pies in front of us. Here's my question. Can I cut up my pie into straight, you know, using straight cuts, rearrange those pieces, and make it look like your pie? So can I take my polygon with a pair of scissors, cut it up into pieces, rearrange the pieces, and make it look like your pie? That's my question, Jane. What do you think?
Well, I would on the face of it say yes. Yes,
yeah,
you can.
It seems possible, right?
Right.
So here's the punchline. First of all, you know that, I think you might be assuming this thing, that our pies have to have the same area, right? If they don't have the same amount of stuff, there's no way I can rearrange my pieces and make it look like yours,
sure,
unless I start eating the extra pie that's left over.
Right.
But let's pretend if they have the same area, are there any other restrictions? Think how complicated these things can be. Do the pies have to have the same perimeter or the same angles? No matter how complicated your pie looks like, can it always happen? And it turns out in the early 1800s, it was shown that it's absolutely true. As long as they have the same area, you can always rearrange my pie and make it look like yours. That's all you need.
So even if your pie has many different angles because it's a
tons,
different
polygon. Exactly. So you can make mine like, Exactly, right? You can make mine really small and thin, like a super thin triangle that almost looks like a line, right? But really small and thin. And yours could be something like that looks like a Mickey Mouse shape, right? And as long as it has the same area, I can always rearrange, cut and rearrange my pieces and make it look like yours. That's cool. Old result, 200 years old. Nothing that exciting. Here's the problem, though. David Hilbert, one of the superstars in math in 1900, he went to Paris to the International Congress of Mathematicians, and he asked 23 problems at that time period, he said, in 1900. And he believed that those 23 problems will shape math for the next 100 years. And some of those 23 problems he asked are still unsolved today. In fact, they're called the Millennium Prizes. There's seven of them. You get $1 million for solving them. And problem number three out of his 23 asks the 3D version of this. So if somebody gives you, instead of a flat polygon, somebody gives you a polyhedron, like a block of wood. Let's pretend you have a block of wood and I have a block of wood. Flat sides, can have as many angles and as complicated as you want, but just nothing curvy. Can I take my block of wood, take a saw, cut it into pieces, rearrange the block of wood and make it look like yours? That's what David Hilbert asked. Is that possible? We know the 2D version, the flat version, was done in the 1800s, and he wanted to know, is that possible for the 3D version? And again, you know, they have to have the same volume, right? Or else there's no way we can do that. And his question is there anything else you need? Like, do you need to tell me any other piece of information, or is volume enough? Because area was enough for the 2D version. And this is huge, one of the big 23 problems. It turned out that it's not enough. It's not always possible. For 3D, it completely fails. That there are two blocks of wood you can actually think of, that one, there's no way you can cut and rearrange as hard as you want to will ever make it look like the other one.
So why?
Yeah, that's a great question, isn't it? And I think, to me, to get students excited or to even get people excited about math, I think math is about just puzzles and problems and structure and pattern in life. And the key to get people math excited is to first tell them the limits of cluelessness. And actually, it turns out mathematicians are actually clueless in so many things that it's not really hard to get there. And once you kind of bring them to the edge of, you know, knowledge of where we are, that's where you have to introduce, I think, our students, right? You take like two-year-olds there, five-year-olds there, college students there, and you say, look, we have no clue what to do after this thing. And then they ask the question, why? And then you sucker them in, right, into taking classes.
Chris Danforth, I didn't, you know, ID you at the beginning of the show as our clueless mathematician for the day, but do you agree with Sethyan there that part of it, part of the excitement of working in this field is that idea of not understanding or not knowing everything?
You know, it's remarkable, and I completely agree. So, you know, just even this morning, there was an announcement about prime numbers and how they're distributed. It's something that people have been thinking about forever, and it's glaringly obvious now that people are looking at it, but nobody has any idea why. And it's an example of how, you know, we just... You know, it's an example of why the field is so exciting and why, you know, it doesn't surprise us that kids are really into it.
So, Sethyan, how do you get people interested? I mean, you work with students, Chris Danforth works with students, and you mentioned that, you know, you can take a two-year-old and get them excited, or a 20-year-old and get them excited. Are you doing it with questions like these?
Yeah, I think, you know, something I believe really strongly, Jane, is the notion of the physical. And what I mean by that is I think in so many times we think math is a very cerebral thing. Like, we think as an artist or a musician, you know, they're touching a cello or they're touching a piano or they're touching a paintbrush. And maybe somebody in sociology or somebody in history, you know, they're looking at history books or they're actually interviewing people in the field and they're getting, you know, they're actually having contact with some physical things. But math, you almost feel like is like, you know, this happens in your mind. And I think the moment we go into that world, we actually are turning students off. I think I want to get kids excited about holding things in their hand. Like, what does it mean to build something, to look at something, to actually take a piece of pie and cut it up, right? Take a piece of paper. So let me give you, can I give you another example?
Yes, please do.
Here's something that we have. David Hilbert's problems about number three that says it's not possible, and even this other one, these are all solved problems, right? Although they were hard to do, they were done. Let me give you a problem that nobody has a clue today. I think it's one of the oldest math problems that I know of, 500 years old. It was actually motivated by the work of Albrecht Dürer, this famous painter-lithographer. And here's the question. Instead of actually, since it's pie day, instead of talking about the pies, let's talk about the boxes the pies come in.
Okay.
All right, you get the box from a bakery. Usually looks like a cube or, you know, some rectangular kind of box. And here's the question that was motivated by Dürer. He says the following thing. Can you take the box, take a pair of scissors, and cut along the edges of the box, sort of where the seams are of the box? Can you do that so that the following happens? So that you can still have one connected piece and then be able to unfold the flaps and lay it flat. All right, that's his question. Mm-hmm. So, of course, if I cut along every edge of a cube, let's take a cube and cut along every edge of the cube, you get a bunch of squares, and you could lay those flat on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, can you keep it into one connected piece and still do this thing? Well, if you think about it just for a little bit, you know, you could actually imagine cutting along the vertical lines of the cube and take the kind of the top part of it off, and it actually, you can imagine unfolding it and laying it flat like a, like almost like a cross.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the four sides come up, and then the flap on top closes at the top of it. So it's a connected flat piece. So we know you could do this for a cube, and Durer was struggling with this thing 500 years ago for lots of different shapes. But here's the question. Can you do this for any shape of a box possible? Instead of just a cube, can you think of any other shape of a box? Can you always unfold this object possible? And mathematicians today, we have no clue whether this works or not. We have no clue. So every kind of a convex box you can think of, convex simply means any point in the box can see anything else, kind of looks spherical. Every example we try, where no matter how complicated these kind of polyhedral boxes are with flat sides, it always works. Every box we've ever tried, there's always a way to cut along some edges and lay it flat. But we don't know the principle of whether this is always going to work, or we don't know if somebody like you or one of your listeners are going to come up with the shape of a box that it doesn't work for.
So you can't prove that this works, but every person who's ever tried it, it has worked for.
You totally nailed it. Exactly.
Phew.
Right. And that's the forefront. To me, I would love to share this problem to somebody in third grade, right? And to say, listen, if you try this thing, you are basically at the forefront of knowledge, and you know almost as much as anybody else in the world does. And to get students excited, to get children excited, or even to get somebody who's 85 years old and thought math was the worst thing they've had when they took trig in high school, to get them excited about actually taking a pair of scissors, actually looking at boxes and shapes in their hand, and saying, wow, now I'm at the forefront of knowledge. How cool is this? To me, that's what I love.
Yeah, it's a very cool thing, and I appreciate you sharing those questions with us. And now I feel like I have to get off the air and go start cutting up boxes. Sathyan Davidos is a professor of mathematics at Williams College. This year, he's on leave teaching at the Claremont Colleges in California. Sathyan, thank you so much for joining us. It was such a pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much, Dane. My pleasure.
And Chris Danforth, before we let you go, I mean, Sathyan just sort of set it up for us there, the fun of math and these questions that are unknown for you. Is this a fun time to be in mathematics?
It's a very exciting time. You know, one of the big reasons is all the data that's coming in from people's mobile phones, from social networks about the structure of how we communicate and what effect those structures have on our behavior, how we influence each other. It's really a very, you know, it's a very exciting time. We have at UVM, we actually have two new degree programs. We have a data science undergraduate degree and a master's in complex systems and data science to help teach people how to do these sorts of things.
That's very cool. Happy Pi Day. Thank you so much for being with us today. Chris Danforth is a UVM professor of mathematics and statistics, and we're going to end with a note from Peg, who wrote in with a joke from a sign set hanging in her library at home. There are three kinds of people, those who can do math and those who can't. Coming up, an alleged butane hash oil lab was shut down in Winooski last week. We'll fill you in on what butane hash oil is and why the cops shut down the lab, even though technically making this stuff is not illegal. That's next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, the Winooski police shut down a clandestine drug lab in the heart of the city, but it wasn't a meth lab. The people in the apartment were allegedly making butane hash oil. It's a very high-concentration THC resin made from marijuana, and highly flammable butane gas is used in its production. But it's not actually illegal in Vermont to make butane hash oil. So here to explain the legal conundrum and why this kind of manufacturing operation can be so dangerous is Lieutenant Reg Treya, commander of the Vermont State Police's clandestine laboratory enforcement team. Lieutenant Treya, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I said butane hash oil is a high-concentration THC resin. Anything else we need to know about what it is?
It is, you know, we look at it as on the clandestine lab team as a lab. It is a lab. You are taking a substance, you are mixing chemicals with it, and you are making an additional substance with it. So we look at it as a lab.
How is it actually used or taken?
Well, what happens is when the process is done, then they can take the, they call dabs, or shatter. It's what they, what it's made into, and then they smoke that with a tube, you know, with a pipe. We've also seen it in the e-cigarettes.
Hmm. So sometimes you'll find butane hash oil inside e-cigarettes, presumably
yes.
not the ones that are sold commercially in Vermont.
Yep.
Yes, it is in the ones that are sold commercially. You might find it there.
Oh, no, no. We have seen them.
Oh, I see. Okay. And describe now the process, what exactly it is that makes it so dangerous to make butane hash oil.
Well, in the process, you're taking a lot of the, you know, let's say garbage marijuana, the leaves, the stems, stuff that would normally be discarded. And you're packing that into a glass or a plastic tube. And then you're filling it full of the butane. What that does is when you fill it the butane, it dissolves the trichromes, which is in the marijuana. It's a very efficient process, which will result sometimes in a THC content of 90% or greater. Now, in content, the average THC content of a marijuana joint is about 5 to 10%, where this will make it up to 90%. So it's a very powerful high that you get. Once all the liquid from the butane is shot through the glass container, it comes out through a coffee filter onto a hot plate, onto a Pyrodex plate. And then you heat that up. And basically what you have to do is you have to cook the butane off in order to get to, you know, the honey oil.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that because the butane is heavier than oxygen, it settles. And when you want to talk about the dangers, think about this. You're using your gas stove and you're cooking this. So the butane rises and then it falls. And that explosive material hits an open flame.
Huh. So, I mean, it can just hit the open flame that you're actually cooking on.
Correct.
Wow. And are you seeing explosions, property destruction, injuries from butane hash oil labs?
We have not as of yet. And, you know, knock on wood, we're just, you know, hoping that trend continues, at least that, you know, people are, you know, not getting to that point where they're blowing themselves or their rooms up.
Hmm. But as I understand it, according to Vermont law, it's not actually illegal to make butane hash oil. So how do you
Well, that's
shut them
not
down?
That's a gray issue. When you say it's not illegal,
the manufacturer.
The material that you're using
mm-hmm.
is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
The material that you produce is illegal. In the state of Vermont, what we're unable to do right now is charge the lab itself. So when we do find marijuana, you can be charged with that. When we do find the process of the finished product for BHO, you can be charged with that. But unlike a meth lab where you can actually be charged with the finished product and the manufacturing, in BHO right now with the current legislation, we cannot charge the lab itself.
Would you like to see a law that would allow you to charge the lab itself in addition to some of the materials that are being used?
I would. And the local legislation, as I see it now, in the proposed legislation for the legalization of marijuana, there is a clause in there about manufacturing the butane honey oil.
So if legalization goes forward, at least in the legislation that's currently there, there would be a prohibition on the unlicensed manufacturing of butane hash oil.
As I understand it right now, as long as nothing changes.
Are you seeing more of these labs in Vermont? Is this an actual concern for you, or is this incident in Winooski something that you think is more isolated?
Well, 5 years ago, I had never heard of this. And now we're actually starting to see it in Vermont. You know, we've had a number of cases in 2015, and we've had a few cases now in 2016. And even the, you know, officers on the road are starting to see some of this stuff on car stops.
So it's a concern for you?
It is a concern, absolutely. I mean, when you're dealing with explosive materials, sometimes in confined spaces, and, you know, the one thing that we're dealing with is, you know, everything that you need to know how to do this is on the internet. I mean, the reason we are kind of, you know, going to the public and pointing this out is that we want people to understand that this is not just, you know, people harmless. This is not people making a harmless product.
Yeah,
this is
a
potentially dangerous explosive atmosphere that they're creating. And we just don't want people to get hurt.
Well, we appreciate you making that point. Lieutenant Reg Trea is commander of the Vermont State Police's clandestine laboratory enforcement team. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You have a great day. Thank you.
And that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, the debate over involuntary medication of psychiatric patients is back. The governor's proposed budget includes language that would speed up the legal process of getting permission to medicate hospitalized patients against their will. We're going to look at that tomorrow on Vermont Edition, and you can send your questions or comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.